Welcome to Living on Purpose on the Rabble Podcast Network. If this is your first time visiting, welcome. And if you are a regular listener, it's so great to have you back. We are so pleased to announce the 10-year anniversary of the Rabble Podcast Network. And of course, this makes the whole Rabble site shine. And as you can hear in the background, what would the world be like with only one bird singing? And it's the same for media. It doesn't need to be one note. There's a diversity of voices in Canadian independent media here on the Rabble site, and you have the opportunity to support rabble.ca by visiting rabble.ca/donate to make your contribution. Thank you so much. And now here's today's show.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Free.
Today's conversation is a recent one with Philip Shepherd. Just under half an hour long today at their family home on Ward's Island, just a short ferry ride off of Toronto. And it's been a couple years since we met up. In the show notes, I'll include the links to the other conversations with Philip in 2012 and 2013.
Well, Lynn Thompson and Philip Shepherd meet again.
And how lovely it is.
On the way here on the train today, being June 5th, 2015, I was reading some of your newsletters that you send out by email because I thought I better get up to speed with what this guy's doing. I just made a few notes and I thought I could throw things at you and see what you said.
Sounds like fun.
Okay. Well, first of all, you have a strong leaning towards being present.
I can't think of a situation in which being present isn't an asset.
In all the various things you do and where you show up. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you're calling the embodied present process?
Yeah, I'd be very happy to.
Because, you see, when I was reading about that and just how excited you are about sharing all of this wealth of knowledge and experience and awareness with others, I just kept thinking about legacy, Philip Shepherd's legacy.
Not dead yet.
No, I know, but the bonus is when you're vital and alive to be feeding forward, you know?
Yeah, which is really what this is about. At this point, I'm the only one who knows the exercises and has a sense of how to teach them. And this, the exercises being legacy. I've developed over decades a number of interrelated exercises that all address that question of how to be present and what divisions do we carry within ourselves that prevent us from being present. And so a lot of the exercises are designed to sort of disclose a division that you might not otherwise be aware of. And people have asked me, you know, who've taken the workshop, do you think this is something I could learn to teach? So I took a shot and announced I was going to do a teacher's training. So I thought, I guess if I'm doing a teacher's training, I better have a name for what it is I'm teaching. And one of the challenges with my work is that the language that I might use to describe it has been appropriated to mean other things. Embodiment, true embodiment, is very different from what people speak of as embodiment. Generally, embodiment, oh, it might be a kind of mindfulness, or it might be that aspect of being able to listen to the body in a deep way. But as long as you're using the language that describes listening to the body, you're setting up a subtle barrier between you and the body, as though the body were next door, and the best you could do would be to put your ear to the wall separating you from it to see what's going on the other side. In our culture, we're so invested in our language and our institutions and our way of being in the head as the leader of the self, as the hero that will save us, that we've lost sight of what it means to truly be embodied. So the embodied present process is the name I came up with for this work I do, and it really points to the fact that until the present lives within you, you're not truly embodied. And it works against the suppositions that we carry that, for example, your being is what you contain within your skin. And to stand independent of the world, or to feel yourself standing independent of the world inside your skin, is to lose your very relationships that call your being into present. So it's only as you come into relationship with the world that who you are is illuminated. It's only as the present begins to live within you that who you are comes into relationship with the world. So it's that recognition of a self that cannot be understood in any way as standing independent of the world. Because in fact, you know, our very word independent is a complete fallacy. Nothing exists that is independent. Everything depends on everything. Everything leans on everything else. Nothing we could conceive of could actually be called independent. And so it really addresses that.
Wow. So you have 14 people.
Well, yeah, so I put out this, I said, okay, I'm going to, you know, give this teacher's training that began last May in 2015. And I didn't know if 3 people would show up, or, you know, I had no idea. And it's like there's this guardian angel who brought exactly the right people to participate in it. They're just luminous, rich, questioning, deeply feeling individuals who have found that this work resonates for them in a way, and also recognize that without diligence, the work is elusive. And so I guess my ideal in teaching, or the ideal that I'm helping these participants towards, is that unless you can model the work in every minute of the workshop, what are you actually teaching? And so the real issue then is to how to bring this work into the body, how to undo the patterns that hold you from your own wholeness. And we're having a ball exploring that.
Well, I'm just thinking maybe it would be helpful to have a couple of kind of examples of things. Like
exercises?
Yeah, like an exercise. But I'm also thinking, like, for example, my left foot is bothering me.
Hmm.
And, you know, instead of just thinking, okay, well, how did I do that? And how can I make it better? I'm thinking, what does it want to tell me?
Mm.
Why is this happening now? Well, I think of it's my heel and my arch. And so it's, I think of it being like digging my heels in.
Mm.
So like, and I think of the left side of my body being the spiritual and the right side being the physical. And so I think the physical wants to go for it, and my spirit is scared and digging its heel in. And it's probably going to keep happening until I can resolve what it's telling me. Now, is that something that would make sense in your work?
Absolutely, but I guess I'd take a slightly different take at it.
Okay.
I really like the work of John Sarno. I don't know if you know it. He wrote a book called The Divided Mind, and he worked with hundreds and hundreds of patients. He was a medical doctor. And he realized that so many of the ailments that people carried were the direct result of unexpressed emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this facility for working with a patient to sort of home in on that unexpressed emotion and bring it to light. And so in my work, you know, you encounter and process the shadows in the body that are pockets of unintegrated energy, unintegrated emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one side of it that really accords with what you're saying. There's another side that's quite different. When something like your left foot hurts you, you tend to pull away from it. You mm-hmm. tend to back off from it. And what happens as we do that is that the energy in our bodies gets higher and higher. Our energy becomes unsettled. And when our energy is unsettled, it lacks coherence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when you're able to bring the energy of your body into coherence that it can untangle the orphaned energies and bring them into coherence. So it's a, probably sounds very abstract, but the reality is it's this felt bodily sensation of noticing without judgment, without trying to amend anything, just noticing where the energy in your body is, where the currents of life are passing through it. And as you notice them, you gently give them permission to melt. And you feel the energy in your body kind of draining down the way water drains through sand, and drain down right through the torso, down through the pelvic bowl, down through the thighs and the knees and the calves, right to the soles of your feet. And you feel that draining down. And the more that discovered energy in the body is allowed to melt and drain, the higher the level grows in your legs, until finally that fluid energy is felt right up to the pelvic bowl, and everything above the pelvic bowl is kind of available, is disencumbered of any caught energy. And as that happens, if you really, really allow that fluid energy in the pelvic bowl and the legs to settle, I mean, really allow it to deeply, deeply settle. So there's this openness from the pelvic bowl up to the top of the head that's just available to the world, and there's this deeply, deeply settled energy in the body. Ailments such as a hurt ankle, in my experience, begin to shift. And it's the very opposite of what, you know, it's almost counterintuitive, because we tend to pull away from something that hurts and to actually flood it with your life's energy in a coherent way, in a way that can bring it back into harmony. For some reason, is a pretty powerful way to go about it, a way to approach it.
Yeah, because not only is there the pulling away from it and the concern, the fear, the worry about it, there's also the compensation for it on the other side.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can totally relate to what you're saying about the unsettled energy, because everything is thrown.
Yeah.
The recent memory of being able to stride confidently forward is quite compromised. And so it's not just a physical movement. It's an emotional movement, you know, so that the whole sense of self and independence, the so-called independence, and just an ease of movement is all altered. Even sitting quietly and thinking about doing something is held back because
the imagination can't go there.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it?
It's very interesting. And definitely there's a lot of layers of emotion going on right now as it's a rich process of uncovering where those, as you say, the pockets are, the shadow pockets, the stories that we tell ourselves in the face of what?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just a phantom.
Yeah, but there's that, I mean, that cognitive part of our mind takes dominance and wants to explain and wants to shepherd and wants to manage. And in my experience, any caught energy in the torso or the shoulders or the head is part of a management system trying to keep control. As long as that management system is trying to keep control, it is treating the body mechanically. It's trying to fix it. It's trying to run it. It's trying to organize it. And it will never work. You just can't. It's not mechanical to begin with. So any attempt to fix it from a mechanical framework is already inappropriate and doomed to fall short. but also that whole sense of control. You're taking this field of intelligence and trying to impose order on what naturally tends towards harmony. And order and harmony aren't correlates or synonyms, they're opposites. We try to find harmony through control, and it'll never happen because control is taking a predetermined order and imposing it on a system, whereas harmony is this ability of an organic whole to allow each part of that whole to answer to every other part. And as every part yields to every other part, harmony is born. And the human body is ripe for that. It's hungry for that. And we don't, you know, we keep that energy of anticipation and control high in the body, and we just don't know how to let it ground. We don't know how to be available to the world in our torsos, and we don't know how to allow that energy to ground deep in the legs and come to rest in the present.
Wow, I'm so in the present, I don't know what to say.
That's pretty lovely. Sometimes words just aren't adequate.
No. I suppose that's a good sign, because otherwise I would be distracted and not listening to what you're saying.
Hmm.
So part of what our mind tries to do too is to look for the familiar, is to make things familiar. It's so rare, really, that we have a completely new experience, because we're constantly remembering who we are, who we think we are, who we're talking to, who we think we're talking to. Whether we've been somewhere or not before, we're comparing it to places that are familiar to us. We're wanting to feel safe and have reference points in the physical world around us, and emotionally too, where we feel safe. I mean, that's a big part of our mandate, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. You know, people talk about surrender and how it's all about surrender, which is true enough in its way, but until you have security, how can you surrender? So it's really, you know, in the workshop, in my teaching, it's a matter of landing in that place of security, landing on the ground of your being. That landing enables you to surrender to the present, which enables you to land a little more deeply in the ground of your being. And it's this back and forth dance between surrender and security. It's a very important one. And that aspect you raised about seeking the familiar, or trying to understand in terms of the familiar, we can only understand by analogy and comparison and metaphor. You cannot understand anything from scratch. So that's understandable enough. But then what we're trying to understand is the present, which is always an unknown. You've never been here before. You never will be here again. It's happening. And so it's more like, it's in a sense more like surfing, as the wave unfurls beneath your board and you dance on it and feel it and course in towards the shore. One of the great impediments in our culture in terms of understanding ourselves and our world is that we, in relying on what we already know in order to understand the world around us, there is only one thing that we completely understand. Only one thing. And so we try to understand all the world in terms of it. And that one thing is the machine. We design the machine, we build it, we maintain it, we repair it, we improve it, we know every little piece of it, we can take it apart so the machine doesn't exist, and we can put it back together, and there it is functioning. There's nothing about my bicycle, for example, that I don't understand. If it breaks, I can fix it. No question, because I understand how it functions in down to each little ball bearing that I've packed in by hand. But the reason we understand a machine is because the parameters of our understanding are delineated by the fact that the purpose of the machine is found in its function. And that's it. And a machine doesn't grow. So we take this one thing we completely understand, then we look at a tree, and we try to understand a tree in terms of a machine, and we understand how, you know, this chemical factory of photosynthesis happens, and how the water is drawn up from the roots through the membranes. And we're looking for, in each instance, this linear causality of cause and effect. And all of that has its place. But what we lose sight of in understanding the world in those mechanical terms is always the context. So an MP3 player, you can listen to it on the beach, you can listen to it on the top of Mount Rushmore, you can listen to it in Manhattan, you press play and it plays, and the context doesn't matter because the function of the machine is this sequence of cause and effect that lies within its case. And then we try to see everything else as standing independent of its context. And nothing living stands independent of its context. A tree is not a thing. But in trying to understand a tree in the terms of a machine, we treat it as a thing. But it's not an object, it's a process. So you begin to look at what is this process of a tree, and you think, well, let's see, but part of the process of the tree are the roots deep beneath the earth. And the process of those roots involves the soil, involves the moisture in the soil, involves the rocks around which the roots grow. It's all part of the process of the roots. And then you think, well, the insects in the soil as well. And then you think, well, then the plants on top of the soil that shed and compost and nourish the soil are part of the process of the soil, which is part of the process of the roots. And the rain is part of the process of the soil. And then, well, the sun that draws the water up into clouds is part of the process of the roots. And the sun, you know, is held in place by galaxies. So you go from the tree and you realize the process of the tree implicates and reveals the universe. It's not a machine. And as soon as you lose the context of something, as soon as you begin to think of it as a machine that you can redesign for your own advantage, you invite the wrath of the law of unintended consequences.
Well, illustrated. Well, Philip, talking about distraction and machines, we could briefly touch on these things that are attached to the end of almost every human arm that I see anywhere I go, with little cords plugged into ears and eyes turned away from the world around us. Any counsel, any understanding of this epidemic?
Well, the appeal of these devices is found in its appeal to the head, to the specialties of the head, to the abstractions that the head loves. All that's fair enough, but what we don't appreciate, and would recontextualize it, is that as soon as you're looking at a little screen, the background of your life blinks out of existence. So that very thing of the machine that stands independent of its context, suddenly your life, your body, your felt relationships with the present may not blink out of existence, but they're radically diminished. Diminished more than you would imagine, because, you know, people talking on their cell phones, on my bike, people have almost killed me. And I stop them and say, what were you doing? You nearly ran me over. Oh, I didn't see you. But they don't realize that their visual field is impaired because it's just disappeared under the spell of this device. So I kind of feel that keenly, and I have a cell phone, but I tend not to have it on just because it doesn't feel good. And that's okay. And it does feel good to many other people, my daughters included, and that's okay too. But as a culture, what we most desperately lack, I think, is our relationship to the world in which we live, and the consequences of that depleted relationship are seen in the suffering that we're inflicting on that world. And until we can open our eyes again to the context of our lives, to this miracle of a planet that spawns such beauty and wonder, we won't find our way back. And the danger of, and I do think it's a danger of these devices, is that they teach us that there is such a thing as independence, and that context doesn't matter. The machine looks to be independent because it seems not to rely on context. And so what it illuminates of me, by looking at that machine, by coming into relationship with that little screen, I am illuminated in a particular way as a mirror of that. And what's being mirrored is my independence of the world, even as my context and my background evanesce. And so how do we come back into feeling the present and feeling guided by it? Because you can't live without guidance of some sort. You can't move forward without something to guide your step. And then you've got a choice. You can either be guided by your ideas, which stand out of relationship with the world as a duplicate or a construct, or you can be guided by the present, which is always there. It's to feel the present is to feel yourself being felt. And in that felt relationship, there's always some subtle, gentle hand guiding you forward. Until we again come back to the guidance of the present and the guidance of our felt relationships with the world around us, that dangerous spiral we're on that's taking us down into solipsism and dissociation and futility can't be reversed.
Well, do we have a hopeful note to end on?
Yeah, of course. There is, it's like coming back to your mother when you do find that kinship in the present. Because there's kinship in everything. We're sitting at this table that's made of wood, and the wood, the grains in this wood tell of winters and summers that my grandparents lived through. Everything is related to everything. And I like that line. There's the movie Starman, and this alien comes to Earth and kind of learns about people, and of course people try to kill him because he's different. But at a certain point in the movie, he says, "I've noticed that when things are at their worst, people are at their best." I think there's some truth in that, and I think as we come face to face with the consequences of our disconnection and dissociation, will wake out of this self-obsession that is carrying us, and will, move from self-consciousness, which clasps each of our lives, into world consciousness, which, softens the perimeter and brings with that softening an incredible richness of being.
Thank you, Philip Shepherd.
A pleasure as always, Lynn.
Thanks for listening to Living on Purpose today. My name is Lynn Thompson, and I am the host and producer of the show since 2004. You have the opportunity to support this podcast and all the other podcasts and the entire Rabble site by going to rabble.ca/donate. Thank you so much.